طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
And welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we broadcast it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We begin with Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima exposing the history of lies behind the Israeli narrative concerning the alleged role of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza as in Hamas headquarters, which, according to the narrative, justified the destruction of the hospital complex. The continuing inability of Israel to provide evidence of this allegation is raising deep concerns about its veracity. Here is Ali Abu Nima analyzing the Al-Shifa Hospital allegations.
Since early this morning in Gaza, Israeli invasion forces have been raiding and ransacking Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest medical center. The occupation army is in the dialysis building without bothering to bring fuel to help patients, the hospital's director, Mohammed Abu Salmiya, told Al Jazeera Arabic. We cannot reach the pharmacy to treat patients as the occupation shoots everyone who moves, he said. Abu Salmiya described being unable to communicate with doctors throughout the hospital, and he said he was unaware of the state of the dozens of premature babies being treated at the facility. He said no one from the Israeli army has contacted him since the hospital was stormed, and water, electricity, and oxygen are completely cut off. The patient's wounds began to rot significantly after all services in the hospital stopped, he said. The smell of death wafts everywhere. Even before the Israeli invasion of Al-Shifa Hospital, the situation there was dire. Earlier in the day, before troops invaded, staff had buried dozens of bodies in a makeshift mass grave in the hospital's yard. Omar Zarkout, the emergency coordinator for Al-Shifa Hospital, told Al Jazeera Arabic by phone that the situation was getting more desperate every hour and more people were dying. He said the Israeli forces storming the hospital had detained many of the displaced people sheltering there, blindfolded them and stripped them of their clothes, and then took them to unknown destinations. The Israelis blew up most of the hospital gates and shrapnel hit many people, Zarkout said. And he added that no one had seen the Israelis delivering any supplies as they had claimed they would do in their social media propaganda. An important point that Zarkout made, and that others present on the scene have emphasized in recent hours, there have been absolutely no exchanges of fire, and that's because there are no Palestinian resistance fighters at the hospital. The only violence has come from the constant shelling and shooting by the invading Israeli forces. Thousands of people, the sick, injured, medical staff, and displaced people are being attacked, terrorized, and in many cases killed. And for what? It's clear that Israel's systematic attack on the healthcare system in Gaza, which has now forced most of the hospitals and dozens of health facilities to shut down, is part of its genocidal campaign to destroy the Palestinian people in Gaza and to make the territory uninhabitable. That's a goal Israeli leaders have publicly and clearly declared. But Israel does have a long-standing obsession with Al-Shifa Hospital in particular that goes back many years. Look at this article in the New York Times from 2009, for instance. It says, quote, "The Israeli intelligence chief Yuval Diskin, in a report to the Israeli cabinet, said that the Gaza-based leadership of Hamas was in underground housing beneath the number 2 building of Shifa Hospital, the largest in Gaza. That allegation cannot be confirmed," end quote. The Times also stated, and I quote, "Weapons are hidden in mosques, schoolyards, and civilian houses, and the leadership's war room is a bunker beneath Gaza's largest hospital, Israeli intelligence officials say," end quote. The Israelis have never presented a shred of evidence that Hamas has a bunker under Shifa Hospital. So why do they keep insisting on this? Take a look at this article from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, also from 2009, 14 years ago. It states, quote, "Senior Hamas officials in Gaza are hiding out in a bunker built by Israel, intelligence officials suspect. Many are believed to be in the basements of the Shifa Hospital complex in Gaza City, which was refurbished during Israel's occupation of the Gaza Strip," end quote. So did you hear that? A bunker built by Israel, according to Haaretz. And look at this article from the pro-Israel publication Tablet from July 29, 2014, during Israel's massive bombardment of Gaza that summer. It states the following, and I quote, "The Israelis are so sure about the location of the Hamas bunker, however, not because they are trying to score propaganda points or because it has been repeatedly mentioned in passing by Western reporters, but because they built it. Back in 1983, when Israel still ruled Gaza, they built a secure underground operating room and tunnel network between Shifa Hospital, which is among several reasons why Israeli security sources are so sure that there is a main Hamas command bunker in or around the large cement basement beneath the area of Building 2 of the hospital, which reporters are obviously prohibited from entering," end quote. Again, that was in 2014. In July 2014, Israel attacked Al-Shifa Hospital, prompting condemnation from the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, among others. And 7 years later, on 16 May 2021, during another of its attacks on Gaza, Israel heavily bombed the area right around Al-Shifa Hospital, killing dozens of people in their homes, an atrocity known as the Al-Wihda Street Massacre. I'm quoting now from an article in The Independent published on May 24, 2021. "The air raids turned one of the busiest streets in Gaza and the main access point to the Strip's chief hospital, Al-Shifa, into a crater-marked moonscape. In place of apartment buildings are mangled heaps of concrete fringed with curls of iron rebar and scraps of belongings," end quote. The Independent continues, "When questioned about the purpose of the attack, the Israeli army said Hamas, the militant group that runs Gaza, bears responsibility for intentionally locating its military infrastructure under civilian houses, thus exposing civilians to danger. It said a preliminary investigation into the attack found that Israeli aircraft struck underground military infrastructure that was located under the road. The underground military facilities collapsed, causing the foundations of the civilian houses above them to collapse as well, leading to unintended casualties," a statement read, end quote. And of course, that was The Independent quoting and summarizing what the Israeli military said at the time of its bombing right outside Al-Shifa Hospital in May of 2021. So let me summarize here. Israel wants you to believe the following propositions. First, that Hamas is stupid enough to use a bunker that Israel itself built and therefore presumably knows everything about. Second, that Hamas is stupid and callous enough to keep using this bunker, even though newspapers in Israel and the United States have for years published its precise alleged location. Third, Hamas is still using so-called underground military infrastructure under Al-Shifa that Israel claims to have destroyed more than 2 years ago. Yes, you are supposed to believe that the same Hamas that managed to take Israel completely by surprise on October 7th in a sophisticated military occupation that destroyed Israel's southern command is dumb enough to hide its most valuable assets in exactly the place Israel says it is. I know it all sounds ridiculous, and it is, but the Israelis are used to having an easy time. The Biden White House apparently believes them, or is at least cynical enough to play along with their lies, and American and other Western media follow suit. Recall that a few days ago, Israel committed another war crime when it raided the Rantisi Children's Hospital in Gaza City, armed with its usual lies about Hamas bunkers under the medical facility. Even though it found absolutely nothing to corroborate those claims, that did not stop Israel's military spokesman, Daniel Hagari, putting out a ridiculous video, and I'm not exaggerating here, claiming that a wall calendar, a baby bottle, a hospital gown, and a bag of diapers were proof of Hamas activity. Let's watch a little clip of it together.
You're now entering into the room where we suspect the hostages were being held. I want you to look at this room. People are putting curtains with nothing above, just wall. No reason to put here a curtain unless you want to film hostages and deliver movies. And now we'll show you more evidence. In this room, there is a list. This list, in Arabic, this list says, we are in an operation. The operation against Israel started in the 7th of October. This is a guardian list where every terrorist writes his name and every terrorist has his own shift guarding the people that were here.
Of course, that alleged list of Hamas terrorists didn't contain any names at all. It was simply a wall calendar. And I like how Hamas supposedly took the time to carefully hang those pleated curtains that were so neat and so properly organized that my own mother would be proud of them. Of course, we cannot rule out, indeed, we can only expect that Israel is going to put out similar propaganda from Al-Shifa and U.S. media will regurgitate it without any challenge. Indeed, Israel is already claiming, according to media reports I've looked at today, that it has, quote, uncovered weapons in the basement of the hospital. That's already a major climb down from their fantasies about a Bond villain type lair for senior Hamas leaders hiding under the hospital. But as I said, Israel does not have to try very hard to get a pass from our so-called media. Let's be clear, though, this attack on Al-Shifa Hospital is as much the responsibility of the Joe Biden administration as it is of Israel. As Reuters has reported, the White House said on Tuesday its independent intelligence supported Israel's claim that Hamas was using Gaza's hospitals, including its biggest, to hide command posts and hostages, while a glimmer of progress emerged in hostage negotiations. John Kirby, the White House national security spokesperson, told reporters yesterday, quote, we have information that confirms that Hamas is using that particular hospital for a command and control node and probably to store weapons. That is a war crime, end quote. Undoubtedly, the so-called intelligence is more garbage fed to Biden by Benjamin Netanyahu. Just like Netanyahu's outrageous false claims that Palestinian fighters beheaded dozens of Jewish babies on October the 7th. It's also just like the perennial Israeli so-called intelligence that Iran is always just a few months from having a nuclear bomb. It's a thin cover for crimes against humanity and genocide. A few hours ago, Barak Ravid, an Israeli journalist closely tied to the American and Israeli political and military establishments, made the following breaking news claim, and I quote, "A senior Israeli official said that the purpose of the IDF operation at the Al-Shifa hospital wasn't to rescue hostages, but to locate and expose a Hamas tunnels hub that connects the hospital with other parts of the Gaza Strip," end quote. Another official reportedly said that Israel never even expected to find hostages, but that the raid was merely a symbol that there is no place that we will not reach. But what about those hostages? What about that command and control node that White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby said were there? The lies just keep coming. Earlier this week, several Palestinian human rights organizations and Palestinian and Palestinian-American individuals filed a lawsuit in U.S. federal court against President Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin to force them to try to stop the genocide. One of the plaintiffs is our dear friend and contributor to the Electronic Intifada, Ahmed Aburtema, whose 13-year-old son Abdullah was killed along with other members of Ahmed's family in an Israeli bombing attack on their house on the 24th of October. Ahmed, by the way, has a new article just published by the Electronic Intifada today, and I hope you will all read and share it. In a few minutes, we will be speaking to Sadaf Dost from the Center for Constitutional Rights, whose lawyers are closely involved in this lawsuit, and she'll be telling us more about it. The Center for Constitutional Rights points out that the United States has a duty under Article 1 of the Genocide Convention to prevent and punish acts of genocide, an obligation the U.S. Congress made law in 1988 when it ratified the convention and passed the Genocide Convention Implementation Act. The duty to prevent is heightened given the United States' considerable influence on Israel. The Biden administration, the plaintiffs say, is not merely failing to prevent Israel's genocide of Palestinians, it is actively abetting it. They also note, the Center for Constitutional Rights, that courts have identified the providing of weapons and other materials to the perpetrators of genocide as a form of complicity. To be culpable, the provider need not share the recipient's genocidal intent. I do not know if this lawsuit will succeed, and of course I hope it will. I just know that we must do everything we can to stop the genocide using every tool, including continued protests and calls to representatives. They may not feel like much, but the pressure is building on our so-called leaders, and the people in Gaza are counting on us not to let up and not to stop demanding a ceasefire and an end to the genocide.
That was Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima reporting through the Electronic Intifada. Next up, a European take on the Israel-Hamas war by Yanis Varoufakis, the outspoken former finance minister of Greece.
Hamas's attacks on October 7th, Israel continues its bombardment and siege of Gaza. While Israel's response has had the full support of the majority of European countries, some dissenting voices are making themselves heard and calling for a ceasefire. So, what role is Europe playing in the Israel-Gaza war? And how has its support for Israel changed over time? I'll ask renowned economist and former Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, in an Upfront special. Yanis Varoufakis, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront. It has been 6 weeks since Hamas's attack on October 7th and the start of Israel's bombardment of Gaza. The vast majority of European governments were unequivocally supportive of Israel, as well as its response. But in recent days, Belgium's deputy prime minister has called for sanctions against Israel. And French President Emmanuel Macron has called to, quote, work towards a ceasefire. Are we seeing a shift in the positions of European governments?
Tragically, it has taken more than 11,000 deaths to see a minute shift, a shift which is so late coming and so small that as Europeans, we should hang our heads in shame.
Hang our heads in shame. What do you think should have been the initial response? Like on October 8th, what should the European Union, what should European states have been saying?
The thing that logic dictates, which is beyond condemnations. We all condemn war crimes. We all condemn horrible, horrible things that have been done to Israeli citizens, to Thai citizens by Hamas, to Palestinians by settlers in the West Bank. But, you know, let's move on beyond condemnation because we Europeans have created this problem. We've created centuries of anti-Semitism, pogroms against the people that came originally from that land, the Jews. Then we subjected them to the Holocaust. Then we supported the vile dogma or dictum of a land without a people for a people without a land, as if Palestine was empty of people. This is settler, white, supremacist language. The British used this in Australia to declare Australia terra nullius, an empty land, empty of people, in order to justify the genocide of the Aborigines in Australia. And not just in Australia, they did in Kenya, they did in South Africa. And, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, the process began by which Europe was trying to get rid of its guilt over the pogroms against the Jews, maybe get rid of the Jews from Europe, by supporting a genocidal, against the Palestinians this time, dictum and narrative. This has been going on for 80 years. So what should have happened at the beginning of October? It's really very simple. We should have demanded the end of the state of apartheid, which creates two different legal systems on the same small patch of land between two different peoples. That is the source of all violence, violence for decades. We have a prime minister in Israel whose raison d'etre, the whole point of his existence, was to destroy the peace process. Netanyahu has one objective in life, to make sure that there is never a two-state solution, the solution that Joe Biden advocates, Emmanuel Macron advocates. So this is what we should have done. Condemn all acts of violence and at the same time say to both sides, to both extremes, we are not going to tolerate this. There is going to be a peace process under the United Nations. There is going to be a complete clampdown on all kinds of violence, whether it's settler violence in the West Bank by Israelis or Hamas violence against Israelis. And we're going to sort this mess out once and for all.
Well, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen proposed a kind of vision of moving forward that engages some of the ideas that you just mentioned. She offered five principles to guide the future of the Gaza Strip. Those include no safe haven for terrorists, no Hamas-led government, no long-term Israeli security presence, no forced displacement of Palestinians, and no sustained blockade. What do you make of the proposal, and does it fully represent what the European people want?
Well, Mrs. Ursula von der Leyen represents no one. She essentially violated all principles of European democratic process by flying to Israel and effectively cheerleading the war crimes of Israel in the Gaza Strip. As for the precise proposal, which comes, I have to say that, we have a duty not to take Mrs. von der Leyen seriously. DiEM25, the movement that I'm part of, we have a campaign and a petition for her removal and dismissal. She's an embarrassment to Europeans. She doesn't speak for Europeans. She shouldn't be there. We should get rid of her as quickly as possible. Having said that, let's take the 5 points you mentioned. Essentially, what she's doing is she's playing the game of Netanyahu of destroying the two-state solution by isolating Gaza from the broader problem of how to have two states living side by side, or if we want to be more humanist and more ambitious, to talk about a single state that is secular and does not discriminate between Jews and Palestinians. She doesn't do that. She separates Gaza and says, let's find a solution for Gaza. Not a solution for the apartheid state in West Bank. Because, you see, allow me to ask a rhetorical question. What if Hamas were to just disappear, you know, surrender to the IDF today? What happens then? What happens in the West Bank, where we have settlers, as we speak, throwing out, terrorizing, killing, murdering, maiming Palestinians and throwing them off their ancestral land? You have a Palestinian Authority that has been completely humiliated and deprived of any authority over the West Bank, and you have a government which clearly says that they are going to annex the whole thing from the river to the sea. What is Mrs. von der Leyen's suggestion for that? Just deal with Gaza. That is to become the useful idiot of Benjamin Netanyahu. That's who Mrs. Ursula von der Leyen is. That's why we Europeans must band together and get rid of her.
Earlier you talked about Europe's long history in the hatred of Jews, the prosecution and persecution of Jews, violence against Jews. Is this Holocaust guilt that leads to this place of sort of not pushing back sufficiently against Israel's policies and practices? I'm asking that partly because there was a poll conducted by Politico in 2021. It found that 41% of those polled in Europe agreed that, quote, against the background of the history of the Holocaust, Europe bears a special responsibility for Israel. Now, 39% disagreed, but 20% don't know. I mean, that's a sizable number of people. And so it makes me wonder if that informs their decision to not more strongly condemn Israel's actions.
Partly, yes. Look, there is a very good reason why we Europeans bear the guilt over the Holocaust. It is because we are responsible for it. Not just the German Nazis. The Croat Nazis, the Greek Nazis, the Hungarian Nazis, the French Nazis, or the collaborators. We all played a small part, not individually, but in terms of our culture, in terms of our nations, in that uniquely evil event in the history of the world, of humanity, called the Holocaust. But the question I put to my fellow Europeans, especially to my German friends, and I mean that as friends, is this. How far must Israel's ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians proceed before our justified guilt over the Holocaust no longer prevents us from challenging Israel's ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians? So to put it a bit more brutally, how much Palestinian blood do we need to wash off the guilt of the Holocaust?
So it's a provocative question. A week after Hamas's attack on Israeli civilians, you refused to condemn either Hamas or Netanyahu committing atrocities across Israel-Palestine. Instead of condemning either, you condemned Europeans and Americans, as you're doing very much today, as the true villains who have been, quote, making peace impossible in Israel-Palestine. Is it really fair to offset all of these war crimes onto the West? However guilty we all may be, shouldn't Hamas and the Israeli government also be held accountable for their actions?
Of course they should be. But allow me to say that I am a European. If I were Indian or Chinese or South African or Latin American, I wouldn't be saying what I said. But as a European, I am refusing to play the phony game that other Europeans play, especially their governments, who are condescending. They're looking at the people who now are suffering, both Israelis and Palestinians, and Bedouins and Druze in the land of ancient Palestine. Think of what we Europeans do. You know, we look down upon those people and say, oh, you know, you animals, you are killing each other. We're going to condemn you. Whether we condemn, you know, the Hamas people or the settlers or Netanyahu or the PLO, in the end, we Europeans look down upon them as if we are superior. We're not superior. We're infinitely inferior. We, over centuries, have created colonialism. We have created anti-Semitism. We have created the mentality of imperialism. We are behind the massacres that are being carried out by both sides. So we are the last people on this planet, in this universe, who have the authority, the moral right, the high ethical standards that would allow us to look down upon these people and condemn them. I'm not going to play this game anymore. I condemn every war crime. But you know what? To those who say to me, why are you not condemning Hamas? I say to them, well, you lost your opportunity to ask me this question. The moment you fail to condemn the killing of unarmed journalists, Palestinian journalists, non-Palestinian journalists, Israeli journalists, Israeli Jewish peace activists, children, women, old men. You've lost the moment you forgot, you neglected to condemn that. Let's not play this condemnation game anymore. Let's just ask the very simple question. Do we or do we not want to see, from the river to the sea, and I use this expression provocatively, do we want to see from the river to the sea, I don't care about Israel, Palestine, or anything, do we want to see people who live without the fear of being killed with equal civil and political rights? What has happened in the United States in particular? Have we forgotten the great civil rights marches in the 1960s? Why can't we have the same mentality about the land of Palestine and start with one assumption that should be common amongst civilized women, men, transgender, whatever we happen to be? And that is that there should be no discrimination, no apartheid in that land. How are we going to work it out? Whether there will be two states, multi-ethnic states sitting side by side, or one state for everyone that doesn't discriminate between Jews, Bedouins, Druze, Palestinians, Arabs, and so on, I don't care. Let's begin with this.
In the past few weeks, we've seen some of the biggest pro-Palestine marches ever recorded, both in Europe and in the United States. Has there been a shift in the public's attitude toward Palestinians? And if so, will this lead to any kind of substantive government positions changing?
Not really. What we have seen is a truer expression of the feelings out there in our communities. The people of Europe in the majority have traditionally recognized the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians since the Nakba, since 1948. The majority of the French, the majority of the Germans, the majority of the Greeks, we always understood, because it's the obvious thing to understand, that there was an attempt ethnically to cleanse a people. But I do not see our governments shifting fast enough so that we will be able in the future to answer our grandchildren when they ask us, what did you do when the thousands of children in Gaza were being massacred in cold blood?
What some governments have done in response has been to ban protesting.
Yes.
France, Germany, Hungary, Austria have all banned solidarity protests with Palestine. Other European leaders have tried to delegitimize them, framing them all as anti-Semitic or extremist events. One German MP even suggested stripping non-EU nationals of their right to protest. How dangerous is this backlash for European civil rights and the global Palestinian rights movement as a whole?
Well, let me answer your pertinent question with an example. A few days ago, a friend who happens to be an Israeli Jew who lives in Berlin, studied very carefully the German constitution to establish what her constitutional rights as a resident of Germany are. And she discovered that the police cannot ban her from doing a one-person demonstration. That is, standing in the middle of a square with a placard which read, as an Israeli and as a Jew, I say, stop the genocide of Palestinians. And she was arrested. Need I say more? The moment we allow this to happen, the moment we allow our police force, our parliaments, our instruments and organs of the state to tell an Israeli Jew in the middle of Berlin that she's being arrested because of the expression of a view which was not even spoken, but it was written on a placard, that is a very slippery slope to two things. Morbid anti-Semitism. Here you have a white German policeman arresting a Jewish woman who happens to be Israeli as well in Berlin. And the second thing that happens is the end of civil liberties for all of us.
Since the October 7th attacks, there's also been a rise in anti-Semitism across Europe. We've seen Molotov cocktails thrown on a synagogue in Germany. We've seen Stars of David sprayed on residential buildings in France. There was a Jewish cemetery desecrated in Austria. This is all very worrisome stuff. However, some accusations of anti-Semitism have been against people who are simply criticizing Israel's human rights record. For example, in response to Amnesty International stating that war crimes had been committed by all parties, Lior Hayat, the spokesperson for the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, called Amnesty International anti-Semitic and a, quote, propaganda organization that's working for Hamas terrorists. How does one thread the needle between dismissing the idea that all support for Palestine is anti-Semitic without delegitimizing the fact that there is a very real rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes against Jewish people going on right as we speak?
Whenever you have a tragedy like the one unfolding in the land of Palestine, Israel today, the extremes are the great beneficiaries. On the one hand, the gross anti-Semites, and on the other hand, the gross haters of Palestinians. Allow me to answer by means of a personal story. I grew up in a fascist dictatorship here in Greece. We had colonels running the ministries. They were abominable. They were imprisoning Greek Democrats. We lived in fear for 7 years of the earlier part of my life. Now, whenever a foreigner, the German chancellor at the time, Willy Brandt, a great man, criticized the Greek government, he was being accused by the Greek fascists in power here in Athens as being anti-Greek, a mis-Hellenist, right? The equivalent of anti-Semite. Whenever a Greek confronted the fascist government, the fascist government talked about him as a Greek-hating Greek. This is what we have now happening across the world. There is a concerted propaganda effort to identify, to equate opposition to Netanyahu's fascist government and to the apartheid state that he has so successfully created with anti-Semitism. The moment you conflate the two, an objection to a fascist regime which oppresses Jewish intellectuals, Jewish Democrats, just as much as it oppresses anyone else, the moment you identify that criticism of that regime with anti-Semitism, that is the greatest victory of anti-Semites. And to go back to the previous example with Iris Hafetz, psychoanalyst, the woman that I referred to in Berlin, the Israeli Jew that was arrested for protesting, isn't that the height of anti-Semitism? To have a white German police officer arresting an Israeli Jew in Berlin?
Now, a lot of Europe's far-right parties are providing unequivocal support for Israel at the moment. But those same parties often have a deep and long history of anti-Semitism themselves. For example, you have Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party in France, which fully supported Israel. But the party was founded by a former SS member, and another founder, Le Pen's own father, was convicted for minimizing the Holocaust. Many have pointed towards similar trends among far-right parties in Hungary and in Poland and other places. How do you make sense of these trends where far-right parties have these incredibly powerful pro-Israel views, but also deep histories of anti-Semitism?
Well, this is a worldwide phenomenon. It happens here in Greece, too. We have Nazis who were campaigning actively on anti-Semitic tropes. They were even selling those disgusting pamphlets and volumes about Sion and so on, the conspiracy theories against the Jews. And now they are, they are wearing the Israeli flag and egging on the IDF to kill as many Palestinians as possible. You have this in the United States. You have an evangelical movement which is extremely right-wing. It was extremely anti-Semitic for 200 years in the United States. And suddenly they have made the extreme Zionist position, the messianic position, whereby God supposedly is going to reappear in the land of Palestine, and that makes it necessary to expunge all the Palestinians from that land. This is a worldwide phenomenon. It's a very interesting one. I think that sociologists, psychoanalysts, psychiatrists are going to have a field day for the next 100 years explaining it. But But what we see is, you see, that really very simple flip of a switch from a rabid anti-Semitism to rabid Islamophobia. Because in the end, what the ultra-right needs is a group of people to demonize. It so happened that it was the Jews. Now it can be anything. It can be the Syrians. It can be the Palestinians. It can be, you know, the Belgians. It doesn't really matter. They need a scapegoat. They need to be able to point at the people to say, if these people were eradicated, life would be easier. This is what Goebbels did in the 1920s and 1930s so successfully, with the Jews being targeted and being the victims. Today is happening in France. By the same people who were targeting the Jews, they are now targeting Algerians and Moroccans and so on. So the greatest enemy is a fascism that requires scapegoats. The fact that they flip-flop between different target groups is not the issue.
That was the former Greek minister, Yiannis Varoufakis, giving an interesting European perspective on the Israeli war in Gaza. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Monday morning, 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the Internet. Just type in truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on Archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will connect again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.